FM. Listen in colour.
Well, I'm really pleased to say that I'm able to be joined by Charlie Wilson, a real legend of R&B. Thank you for coming in, Charlie.
Thank you.
And as we've discussed already, you know, we're going to talk about your career and going way, way back. Like so many artists, you came from the church.
Yeah.
You sang and played in church, and then you formed what was probably a secular band, I'm guessing. But not everyone did it at 14.
No.
So yeah. How was it at that age, being in that arena?
Well, you know what? It was a lot of fun. My friends and I, we had, you know, some of my best friends. We all learned how to play different instruments together, meaning like if, you know, when we're in grade school or junior high school, we were learning how to play like certain instruments, and we would be the last ones in the school in the bathrooms trying to play this trumpet, or you play this and I play this. And we did that, for, you know, as years grew, we just kept going and learning different instruments and in our own garages. You know, finally we all got together and started making sounds and things like that. And we had a lot of fun learning James Brown and all of these real cool artists. And then we decided to go play like at the YMCA. We had to have a chaperone, of course, which included maybe a teacher or two. So these teachers would look over us while we're playing, you know, maybe cost 25 cents to get in or 15 cents or whatever. And before you know it, crowds, they were getting larger, but they were getting larger with grown people. And so we could play the songs really, really well. And then we had our own touch of little feel to it. And before you know it, we was playing for all of the teachers that was on first name basis with them. It was kind of kooky, but
unusual for a school pupil teacher relationship. Let's
say. Yeah. And then because then when you got to school, then you had to go by these rules, and it just wasn't right. And we went through 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade with this kind of behavior and this kind of thing with the teachers. And so as we got a little older, when we went, that transition went from that to clubs, you know, it was a kind of really a sticky thing because I didn't know anything about it. They call it a tab, where they can, somebody can go get a drink on you and then you have to pay it at the end of the night. Of course, we didn't know nothing about that because we weren't able to drink. But it ended up being like this teacher would drink up $20 or $15 worth of drink, you know, and then that was my salary, $15, $12. I mean, that's how we was making a piece.
It sounds very unteacher-like to me.
Yeah.
Not very charitable.
Yeah, it was unteacher-like because then when you got to class, I mean, when you got to school a little bit late, you know, Wilson, what are you doing in the hallway? I'm like, what? Man, you owe me $15. What the hell's wrong with you? Yeah. You talking to me like that in front of everybody, you know, it was like, it was a sticky situation all the way through high school like that. Yeah.
Right. So as you were growing up, this is all going on in Tulsa, Oklahoma, of course.
Yes, yes.
And as you got older, you know, Leon Russell was the king of rock and roll in mm-hmm. town, and you guys got to be his backing band.
Yeah.
So when you were doing all this stuff, you know, growing up, you're with Leon now, mm-hmm. was this fusion of gospel and rock that you were playing shaping you to become the Gap Band?
Yeah. I mean, it was, that's what drew him to us, is that the feel that we had, the musical feel. The way we played, because we used our upbringing church, because that's basically what we really knew most. You know, my father being a preacher and all that stuff. So when Leon and Buddy Jones finally came into one of those clubs one night and saw us play, it was something different. And then I challenged him. He had a show coming up, and I was like, I would love to see the concert. He said, come be my guest. And we went. And when he finished, I said, hey, man, our band will kick your band's butt. He's like, what? I said, man, your band's weak. And he started laughing. He said, oh, really? I was like, yeah. So he said, gave us about 5 or 6 albums. He was like, here, go learn these albums. And he said, you got 24 hours to do it. Then you can be my band. I was like, really? We called him next day, said, come listen. He was like, no way. No way you learned all them songs. I said, come listen. So he came and he was like, oh, my gosh. These guys learned all of these records, but all we did was learn the intros.
So after the progression through Leon Russell and stuff, eventually the Gap Band gets formed, and in 79 you've got a record deal, and mm-hmm. things don't quite take off straight away, but from the release of the Gap Band 2 onwards, the next 10 years is pretty much full on in terms of success.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It was brutal. We just really thought that no one was connecting. And then we was listening to radio, and we was trying to fit in so hard until I just said, you know what? Well, actually, my brother, we all had a little meeting. He said, you know what? We need to go back to what it is that we just love to do. And while my oldest brother said, while you guys are thinking about what radio should play, we should think about what mom and daddy would do. And that's basically what we did. You know, it says, I said, is that's going to fit on radio? He said, there you go again. We're not thinking about radio. Let's go with the ooch, ooch, ooch,
yep.
Ooch, 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 ooch. Then oops, upside your head. Say oops, upside your head. That's what came. That was it. Just from that beat alone, just that, you know.
But that's got to be the best way of generically writing, isn't it? Because yeah. If you sit down and you think, I've got to write a song for radio, doesn't that kind of put a restriction on you?
Well, absolutely. We were young. We just didn't know, you know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
We always just wanted to have a record on the radio. I mean, when you're coming up, that's what you really want.
You're aspiring to that all the time.
Yeah, that's you gotta understand that. And anybody that's listening, you know, when you're coming up, you want to hear your record on the radio. And if it's not being played on the radio, you think you're a failure. So that's what we were going for. But anyway, after we decided to go against the grain of disco and all of the stuff that was out, we just started with that beat right there and then just put percussions, and we just out there was just all, we all had a little something, and we was just the three of us, and it just was shaking it. And then, you know, we started humming different things to each other, and, you know, and then we stopped and we didn't finish, and we was on tour, we was on road, just on the road doing shows, and we just came up with that groove. My little brother, he just boom, kaboom, kaboom, you know, like that. So it was like he had that feeling. We just, I don't believe you want to get up and dance, you know. So yeah, it just went from there, and then it just had such a hypnotizing feel to the vibe. It just, that worked.
So was that how a lot of your material came about, when you were kind of grooving at sound checks and on the road?
On the sound checks and on the road. That's how every last one of our hits came. From Oops Upside Your Head up until now, they come like that.
So switching to you personally now, without wishing to state the obvious, the first time I heard you was on the Gap Band material. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I've always loved about your vocals is how much you seem to put into every song, even if it's not seemingly personal to you.
Yeah.
And then when you move on to things like Computer Love, mm-hmm, I thought your vocal was the focal point of that song.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to get at is, have you always been conscious about the way that you sing, or do you just step up to the mic and you just basically steam into it?
Well, I was taught this when I was a little boy. At every move and every moment, every breath you take in front of a microphone, my mom, my dad, you put everything you have into it. Every phrase, when you need to make the statement or when you want to make this part believable, then you sing it with belief and the passion. So when I was a kid, that's what I remember. If you could picture this 3-year-old boy singing in church, that's packed full of people. I'm scared to death, but I'm looking at my father because he's looking back at me, and he's giving me that look. You better turn this place out, because if you don't, you're going to have to talk to me when you get home. And so I just snatched this microphone up and just started walking and singing. And just from there, it's just like it lit up. So I was taught to just in every word that you have to have the passion.
Okay, we just mentioned Computer Love there for a second. And you sang on I Ain't Gonna Stand For It for Stevie. Were there many other collaborations that you did, or was it just too hectic with the Gap Band to go and work outside?
There's a lot of collabs. I just can't remember all of them. It's a lot of them. I know some ones that I didn't get a chance to do. Temptations, Eddie Kendricks. I didn't get a chance to sing with Tina Marie. Just a few other people that, you know, I just don't want to keep naming. They're all gone now. Whitney Houston. It's just, I just didn't get a chance, and I feel so bad.
So the Gap Band kind of ended around 1990. Well, obviously there was a live album in 96.
Yeah.
But in 1992, you finally got to make your first tentative steps into being a solo artist with You Turn My Life Around.
Mm.
And had life changed much for you at that point as you were moving out into solo world, as it were?
Man, my life was in shambles around that time. I was drugged out and didn't know my left or my right. I was headed toward the homeless And it just wasn't a good time for me. Although I still had the passion to sing and I wanted to sing. And I got through that. You know, somebody asked me, would I like to do this? Would you like to come sing this? Would you like to have another album? Would you like to do an album? Would you like to do an album by yourself? And I was like, yeah. So I was like, it just didn't work for me. I wanted to sing, but I wasn't there. Mentally, physically, mentally, spiritually, I just wasn't there. I mean, I went through the motions, did the songs, turned my life around. And I remember trying to get in that project. I remember the reason why the song You Turn My Life Around came is because I got myself clean and went and sang that song. And after that, again, just went back to Bolivian.
Ironically, as well, at that time, you know, New Jack Swing had become the new R&B kid on the block. Yeah. But they all sounded like you, like Aaron Hall and R. Kelly. It was all like, you know, honestly, those guys can obviously sing. But to me, it was like Charlie Wilson's B team. I mean, were you listening to these guys thinking, what's this all about?
Yeah, I mean, I remember when Guy came through, Teddy Riley, he had produced Guy and many other artists. Sweat, everybody, that whole the 90s era, he was the one that was making beats for everybody. Aaron told me one time, he said, man, I sleep with your picture in my wallet. He said he studied me and studied me and studied me and all of that. And it was just it made me feel real good. But I was, again, it was a dark time in my life. And I just didn't really know if people really loved me or were they really truthful by saying what they were saying, or they just, were they making fun of me? I was really confused. I can say that now. But and when I heard Guy, Aaron, I first heard it on record, I thought it was some outtakes that I had somewhere laying around. And then I kept listening closely. I was like, that's not me. That is not me, you know. But he was really, really close. I was really happy for him. Then I was upset at myself because the state of mind and the state that I was in drug-wise. So I was, again, just still bitter about the past from being with the Total Experience and just being ripped off. And it was just whole bit, you know, I was just bitter.
Well, thankfully, as we know, things did get much, much better. I stepped off the radio myself in 1990, and although I still listen to new music, but I didn't have to be really involved in it like I was when I was on the radio.
Yeah.
And I kind of lost track with people like yourself who I would look out for constantly.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, 1996, I hear Snoop Dogg and the unmistakable voice of Charlie Wilson is on this track. So how did the Snoop thing all come about?
Well, you know, I had just gotten out of rehab maybe a year and a half, and a background singer of mine that was with the Gap Band at the time, Val Young, she was hanging out with Tupac and Snoop Dogg, and she had been telling them, oh, I sang with the Gap Band, and they didn't believe her. They was like, quit lying, you know? So they finally, Snoop just asked her the question, if you really know Uncle Charlie, then go get him. My wife and I, we went, and I walked in a room where I thought Snoop was going to be, and Tupac was there. And when I found that out, I was like, oh, I would love to sing with Tupac, but I'm here to sing with Snoop. So I couldn't start singing with Tupac because Snoop was on his way. I said, man, let me just get through with Snoop and then I'll come and sing for you. But when I got over there with Snoop, Snoop was just all happy to see me. And we went in there and he locked the door and we started coming up with everything. And I was on all of the albums there out, about five or six more albums after that. We had such a great time, and he's the one that started calling me Uncle Charlie, and we got so close, my wife and I, and him and his wife.
It was really funny because, you know, things are now obviously beginning to really move for you, and there's all this love from Charlie Wilson from probably the unlikeliest of sources, and that's this new hip-hop R&B generation.
Yeah, Snoop was the one who initiated that, and everybody was coming. Tupac was trying to get in the door that night. Not long after that, Tupac got killed. I didn't get a chance to record with Tupac. Then it was Master P, then it was...
Yeah, I was going to say the names just kind of roll off. You know, Kanye West, R. Kelly, Jay-Z, Justin Timberlake, Pharrell, Jamie Foxx. Yeah. It's just,
the list was,
you know, a cast of everyone who is anybody.
Yeah.
During this time, were you actually thinking, please tell me I'm not dreaming? And in a minute I'm going to wake up and this isn't happening? Because you were also suffering a lot of rejection just before this, weren't you? You know, you had a lot of people telling you you were too old,
yeah,
it was over for you, you know, kind of standard practice for the record industry, really.
Absolutely. I mean, we all know that an age limit comes up with the times, you know, where you, okay, this is where you're supposed to sit your butt down. But me, on the other hand, I'm thinking, okay, I was snuffed out from my musical life when I was this a certain age, when I was supposed to be going to the top. Okay, as a solo artist, I've been there as a group, but as a solo artist, okay, I should have stepped off the group when I was 25 years old and did like everybody else. Smokey Robinson, Commodores, Lionel Richie, Chaka Khan, Lef and Rufus. I should have stepped off then, but I didn't step off because what I was trying to do was reinvent and regenerate what we had before. Then I had the drug problem, so that was a force to be dealt with, you know. So it was a wall up for me for a long time. So when I got past the wall, I'm a little older, so people was like, come on, man, you got, I love you, Uncle Charlie, but you know, just retire. And I was like, I'm not going to retire because I still have so much to do. I have a lot to offer, man, you know. So everybody fought against me. So when I found myself a new manager, Michael Perrin, when I found him, that's when my life changed, basically. Because I knew I had somebody I could trust, somebody who could count the money, and I wouldn't have to worry about him. He's going to take his share, and that's it. But that's all I needed, was somebody who, first of all, was going to learn the business, learn it properly, and not deviate from what he was trying to do. And so that's what he'd been doing all of these years. And I just said, man, I just want to sing, and I want to just get back to the top. He said, I promise you, I won't stop until I get you there.
So that's great, because you've got the ambition and now you've got some stability in the background, so you can concentrate properly on the artistic end of it.
Absolutely. There's no type of music that I can't do, conquer and make fun out of it.
Let's move forward to 2000 now. Mm-hmm. I think 2000 is a bit of a sort of a mark year for you, because it begins a really golden period, which is still going.
Yeah.
You know, you release Bridge the Gap then.
Yes.
Then in 2004, things really kick off. You get the gold album with Charlie Last Night Wilson.
Yes.
In 2008, Uncle Charlie gives you the double Grammy nomination.
Yes.
Then in 2010, Just Charlie's in the top 10, also gold, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with this period now, because you've had previous success and then, of course, a lean period, what are the old lessons learned were the most valuable to you during that period?
To not take things too serious.
Well, that seems fair.
Don't take things so serious. Just go have some fun. You're living a good life. You're able to do things that nobody else has done, and ride it out. And when it's over, it's over. And I don't think people should judge when it's over. As long as I can sing, as long as I got the energy level, I'm just going to have some fun, man. That's what I'm here to do. And I'm not stopping till there's no fat lady singing. So I'm not stopping till they put me in the ground.
Okay, I want to talk to you about some artistic stuff for just a few minutes. Tell me about your writing team. I know that one of them's Whirly Morris, who goes back to the Gap Band days, for example.
Man.
So tell me about the team.
I have a great team of writers. Whirly Morris is from Atlanta, Georgia. He's also from the church, and he knows me. He knows the kind of music that I love. There's Greg Pagani, same thing. He knows what I love. Everybody around him loves Charlie Wilson. And so it's easy for him to write quickly because people he has around him at the same time is shooting ideas at him for Charlie Wilson. Emil, same thing. These guys live and breathe Charlie Wilson all day, every day. And so when they bring me a song, it's basically almost already there for me.
Yeah, I like this idea of a kind of constant team, if you like, because with the guys that you've worked with, people like Timberlake and all these other guys, it would be very easy for you to just go off and say, Justin, you know what, put me in touch with that bloke who just wrote you that hit.
Absolutely.
And just take it. But I think to be involved in that kind of little squad, if you like, it's much more personal, and I think you'll get more personal music out of it.
Absolutely. Although some of these other guys are saying, you know, oh, let me write something for you, or can you come over and put some vocals on this? It's great, man. I mean, like, I love Justin, and I love his team of writers, too, but everybody's coming at Uncle Charlie right now. to get some of that real R&B.
So, okay, we're up to the present time now. Earlier in 2013, Love Charlie's released. Oh. Once again, incredibly successful. And now you get the news you're to be honoured with a 2013 BET Lifetime Achievement Award. Now, does that beat the Grammy nominations?
It's equal in my eyes. As equal. To be nominated, to be greeted with a Lifetime Achievement Award, it was such an honor. Such an honor, man. I don't even really know how to talk to you about that. The feeling that I felt at the moment he told me that I was being honored, man. But I did go home and tear up, you know, it's because I was like, okay, is this when I'm supposed to sit down? I mean, because when you're being honored for a Lifetime Achievement Award, that means you've been doing it for a lifetime and it's probably time to sit down. So I didn't really know how to accept it because I feel like I was just getting started again. So I was like, okay, this is big for me. And how do I accept it? And how do I turn this into something, a night not for me just to remember, but everybody else to remember? So we put our heads together, my manager and I, and we just started coming up with things that we could do. And man, people was coming out of the woodworks to come and pay tribute to me. But we couldn't put all of these people on this TV. They only had a few minutes. So my manager, I said, you're going to have to make that call. So he picked the names.
Well, you did a good job because there are those two fantastic clips on the BET website. And at the end of the day, you managed to fit in India RE, Stevie Wonder, Jamie Foxx, Snoop Lion, Pharrell, Justin Timberlake, and your good self. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, by the way, everyone, do go to the BET website and watch those clips because they're fantastic.
Oh, my gosh, that was one of the best days of my life. I would never, ever forget it.
So staying with 2013, something that's kind of, not weird, but coincidental, as a mirror image of when you were with the Gap Band, you know, they had the lead song in a movie, and now this year you've done the same thing. You got the lead song on Best Man 2, which is I Still Have You.
Yeah, an incredible move. That was another manager. I don't know how he pulled it off, but he came and told me that the people said that it would fit in a great scene, and I was like, you know what, you're full of it, but such a great movie too. Oh my gosh, it's a huge movie. I'm having a great time right now.
And it's still not over because here we are now with another Grammy nomination.
Yeah.
This time it's for Best Gospel Song for If I Believe. This, of course, is on Love, Charlie.
Yes.
Now, outside of your other nominations, does it now feel that you've got your gospel roots recognized as well as the R&B thing and everything else?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that. It was great. I mean, this was a song that my wife, she came up with this idea, and she said she had dreamt it, and I would possibly be able to sing it on the Grammys. This is what she said she saw in a vision. So when she came to me with the song, said a lot of great things, and so we just had to try to mold it down to something. We had a great time recording the record, and here's this nomination for the Grammy for it. I had no clue, but she already had said it. She said it like a year and a half ago. She said, I envisioned and I saw it would be nominated. And I was like, how could you know that?
So as we stand right now, your solo success has completely eclipsed what you did with the Gap Band. You've had more Grammy nominations, more number one singles, bigger charting albums. And from what I would also call your generation of singers from, say, the 80s, I think you're the only one that's left that's still performing with a high level of success. A lot of them are out there, but they don't have the high level of success that you've had. What's it been like finding this new generation of fans? Obviously, you've still carried a lot of fans with you, but you must be aware of this new generation now. How has that been, reacting with a younger generation of people that love Uncle Charlie?
Wow, that's another question I really can't hardly answer, except for I have the passion. And my work ethics are different from the other singers from the 80s. A lot of those people have had Grammy success, and they've had the number one records, the big pop records. And some of them think that they can dangle those accolades and get back to the day. But you have to work. So with that passion, it allows me to go with this young spirit that I have and strive for something bigger and better. I still have that drive in me. And I don't think some of those singers from the 80s has lost the drive. My band and I are so energetic, and everything is so high energetic on the stage because that's the only way that I know how to perform, is the way I performed from the Gap Band days, and I just carry it up to now. And people are still trying to ask me, what are you doing? What are you drinking? Or what are you doing? I'm not doing anything. You drink water. That's all I'm doing 18 years clean and sober. I quit smoking in 2000, which is 13 years, getting ready to be 14 years. I don't need anything to go to the stage anymore. That was just a facade. I just take my own spirit, the drive I have, and the passion, and we're going for it.
When I get to speak to people like yourself, who I describe as heritage artists, I always ask them this one question, because you've been around long enough to be able to answer this. And what's interesting for me is whenever I ask it, every artist gives me a different answer, okay? Mm. Now, when I asked Alexander O'Neill this question a few months ago, he said to me he thought the melody had gone. And what I'm going to ask you is, what do you think of the current R&B scene and wow. where it's gone artistically in recent years?
Well, I think R&B is coming back. It's coming back strong. I'm the leader right now in it. But he's right, sort of to a point, that the melody, because nothing stays the same and things has to change. Now, if you're not willing to make that change with the melody, because there's new generation up in there, in their mind, in their ears, they're hearing different things. So you can't keep that same melody that you had in the 80s and the 90s and think that that's going to work here, not exactly that way. Now, you can have that, some of that, but you have to mold that and straddle the fence. You have to keep what you love and give them something that they love.
I think you're slightly, lyrically, a little bit more traditional, though.
Absolutely. I can skew it to what they want to hear. Now, I can give you a little of that slang. I can give you a little bit for you. But I can't take you into the bedroom because you're too young. That's no need of me talking like that.
Well, you don't take the bitch hoe route. Let's be honest, okay? Let's cut to the chase here.
Yeah, I can't go to the bitch hoe. I can't start doing that because then it goes like, man, what the hell is he doing? You see? So I have to be a little bit careful. You follow me? I don't want to have that kind of attention.
Okay, we're drawing to a close now, but I want to ask you just one final question about something I know is very, very important to you. And I know you're also a prostate cancer survivor. Mm, yeah. And that for 5 years now, since 2008, you've been a national spokesman for the Prostate Cancer Foundation. Mm. And I read a statistic, which I must say was a real eye-opener, and that is 1 in 3 African-Americans can be affected by prostate cancer.
Absolutely. And we have to pay close attention to our own selves. And we as black men, I can speak clearly for the ones especially in America. We don't like to go to the doctor because we don't want to know what's wrong with us when you get to past a certain age. Even when you're younger, you're doing a lot of things. You're having a lot of unprotected sex. You know, all these things that we're doing, we're getting drunk, we're getting high. We're having these parties and it's been going on for years and years and years. But we don't want to go and get a checkup to see if we're all right. We're just saying, okay, I'm going to die of something. But don't you want to know what that something is? Because if you do, if you can catch it early enough, then you don't have to die of that something. And I always urge men to go get this prostate checkup, because when you get past a certain age, you're going to have problems with your prostate. I don't care who you are. And I always like to talk to the younger men so they'll understand it. We need to break that cycle of silence, because my grandfather wouldn't dare talk about it back in the day to around the women, and my father didn't either, because it was like a man thing. It's like, oh, if I let you know something going on with my prostate, then that's a man thing. I lost my manhood, sort of like. So I wanted to break that cycle. This is why I became a spokesperson. So we can just let's talk to the younger men. Even the women, because the young women, because if you're 20 something years old and you're married, she needs to know what this problem is when you get to a certain age so she can talk you into going to the doctor. It's no need to be hiding that. Pretty soon you ain't gonna be able to get it up and you're trying to figure out why, because you have erectile dysfunction. Early detection is the key. That's what I'm saying. You have to go, you know, your health provider and let's find out what's going on with you.
Well, listen, seriously, thank you very, very much for your time. Take care, Charlie Wilson. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jazz FM. Listen in color.